My grandfather died in 1933. He was the original illustrator of When Worlds Collide for
Welcome to Star's End, a Foundation podcast. This is a podcast dedicated to the Foundation universe, both the classic novels written by Isaac Asimov and the upcoming adaptation from Apple Plus. I'm John, and I'm your co-host.
My name is Dan, and I'm also the co-host. We're going to read Asimov's novels together and talk about how they look from a 21st century perspective. We'll also talk about show news as it comes out. And when season one airs later in 2021, we'll talk about each episode.
And I'm Joseph. All three of us are middle-aged white guys who read the Foundation novels as teens, but we're not here to gatekeep, just the opposite. After all, Foundation is about how societies must evolve or die, and we want to help hand this story off to younger and more diverse hands.
This week, we're going to introduce ourselves to our listeners and to the Foundation stories, how we came to get together to do this podcast and what we hope to accomplish by it and what topics we hope to touch on in the future. So, Foundation, here we are to talk about one of the, if we like, the foundational pieces of science fiction in the history of science fiction. I know that I encountered it in the 1970s as a child. Asimov was one of the greats that I used to read everything that I could find from Arthur C. Clarke and Ray Bradbury, Robert A. Heinlein, and of course, Asimov. There was the iRobot stories, all the robots. There was Pebble in the Sky, and there was Foundation, which really was his masterpiece, originally a three-part series written in the 1940s. And I think that Dan and Joseph probably have similar experiences of how they came to Asimov and came to Foundation, but I'll toss it out there to you guys. How did you get to Isaac Asimov and Foundation?
Yeah, well, I got to it through my dad, like a lot of my science fiction leanings. My dad introduced me to a lot of the stuff he had been reading. I started a little bit later than you did, John. I picked it up in the 80s.
I'm old. That's the problem.
I'm slightly less old, but not young. I remember seeing Asimov speak in person once at my local temple in suburban New York. He's really engaging speaker, funny guy. There's a capacity crowd. He's just cracking people up. And there isn't a whole lot of humor in the fiction, but it's fun. It's fun fiction. He's dealing with the fate of galactic empires, and it still remains kind of light, kind of pop fiction. Not that it doesn't get into serious subjects. It does take on big issues of history and destiny and so on, but there's a kind of pop culture sensibility about it.
Yeah, he's definitely got the space cowboys and the gunfighter types and the predecessors to Han Solo kind of rogues out there. Joseph, how did you come to all this?
It's very similar. I kind of grew up a Star Trek fan basically before I can remember. Around junior high school, I started getting into more serious science fiction. A friend loaned me The Wind from the Sun by Arthur Clarke. And after that, I was off to the races. I was devouring Clarke and Asimov and Heinlein pretty precipitously. Interestingly, my recent experience with Asimov has mostly been through his nonfiction stuff. You guys have encountered the website I Write Like. You put in a sample of your writing. It says, your writing is very similar to this person. If I write something for students, the answer I want to get back is Isaac Asimov. Really kind of, especially with the series coming up, looking forward to revisiting this stuff and enjoying it all over again and maybe having a much more modern look at it.
Yeah, it's funny. I always, even as a kid, I found Asimov's writing to be, let's say, unedited. I think that was the way he liked to do things. He liked to sit down in front of a typewriter and pound out words and pound out stories. And I think he was interested in the stories, and he didn't shy away from the pulpy stuff. Comparing him to a Bradbury or an Arthur C. Clarke, I found them to be more literary. And I know it's not exactly groundbreaking to say that about Asimov. I think he might've said the same thing, although he might've been a little miffed about it too. It's funny you talk about seeing him live, Dan. I saw him live also at Stevens Institute in New Jersey, and he was a wonderful speaker. I still remember so much of what he was talking about and how, you know, how he really engaged the audience. But as a writer, I always did feel like here was a guy who was just so prolific. He was just going to get out as much as he could get out. And he was not going to go back and worry about sentence structure and whether he had properly foreshadowed what was coming later. He was going to get it out, and he was going to move on to the next thing. Dan, have you read any of his nonfiction stuff? Because I really never have.
Not much. I mean, just a couple of essays here and there. I've read things like essays appended to some of the fiction that talk about his process of writing and so on. And I think I've read one or two essays by him about popular introduction of real science. Not seriously. I haven't read much. So yeah, Joseph, what have you read?
Really, the motherlode is for 30 years, he did a monthly column on science back for the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. Those have been collected into books, and they're just wonderful. You have 15, 20 minutes, and you want to get a nice little introduction to something, just something to be occupied with. They're generally delightful, and it's usually a wonderful anecdote to start the thing off and kind of be really engaging, and then nice, clear, intelligent exposition of the topic. Wrote a thing on imaginary numbers that I stole from liberal. Actually, I didn't steal from because I quoted it, but I've used that with my classes. It's very good.
So Foundation was extremely early for Asimov. And interestingly, I don't find it to be immature compared to his later stuff. I was actually surprised in going back to realize that he started writing these stories at the age of 21. And that, you know, he wrote, I think the first story came out in 1941. Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote all the way through either 1950 or the early 1950s before he finished the whole series. And it does read very much like his later stuff. For better or worse, there does not seem to be, you know, as I said, immaturity in the writing. You know, just from reading the introduction, I mean, I'm not going to pretend that I had some secret information, but the introduction to this series that I was reading, it talks about Asimov being obsessed with the rise and fall of the Roman Empire and asking himself whether that fall was inevitable or not. And Joseph Campbell, the great editor, encouraged him to not just look at a tiny little piece of it, but to look at the whole scope and to try to talk about the large scope of the potential fall of an empire. And the question that, you know, originally he was asking was it inevitable? And that led him to this idea of psychohistory, the science that the hero of the early part of Foundation, Harry Seldon, has developed, the science which allows you to predict the behavior of extremely large groups of people. And he has predicted that the Galactic Empire is going to fall. There's going to be a horrible interregnum of 30,000 years. And he's got a plan to reduce that 30,000 years down to just 1,000 years. And that is the Foundation. I mean, it's, to me, quite an interesting idea, really. Here's 21-year-old Asimov who comes up with this idea of a science of predicting human behavior, and the rest of the story follows from it. And I do find that quite an inspiration. Whatever else you want to say about Asimov and Foundation, that's really that's a great starting point. You know, and he took it forward from there.
And so unlike what, at least I'm not an expert on mid-century science fiction, but it seems so unlike the main focus of what science fiction was back then, when it was really hardcore kind of focused on, when it was knowledgeable, it was focused on the actual science. When it was not knowledgeable, it was focused on, you know, little green men from Mars and kind of adventure stories, right? And to take things in the direction of, you know, social science and build a large-scale space opera epic about the development of a social science was really weird and great, especially for such a young guy.
It absolutely was. And, you know, as he wrote it, as he went along and the story developed, he really developed this whole thing into an idea of a true change to human beings, a true change to the way we govern ourselves, going from this, the physical science of the first Foundation, and not to spoil too much, but to the mental science of the second Foundation. But it was really a vision that he was developing of a different way to govern human beings. And, you know, I don't think that ever really got analyzed as much as maybe it could have. And it's a pretty radical idea. It's a technocratic idea that at the top of society, there will be these mental giants who can literally manipulate everyone else to make sure that society runs along proper lines. And it's a pretty radical idea, I find.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suppose it's still radical given to the degree to which we now live in an age of, at least in some quarters, widespread suspicion of technocratic elites. So I guess these are ideas which remain contested even to this day.
Oh, yeah, well, there's been, in the United States, there's been a history of anti-intellectualism, sadly. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that we're talking about the shift to social science, because this is the thing that Ballard and Dick and then that second wave of British science fiction writers, in particular in the 60s, were known for segueing into. And here we have Asimov doing it at the start of what could be considered the golden age of science fiction.
Yeah,
absolutely. I don't know if at the beginning he really had that in mind, but as things developed over that decade, it really did go that way. And particularly when he came back to the series later, which is probably something we should talk about, he did very much came back to those ideas. So let's talk about that. We have this, this mini series coming out, but we don't know very much about, possibly later this year.
I think they have announced that it will have a 2021 release date, but I think that's all they've announced so far.
And we've seen the cast, a very interesting cast. Jared Harris is going to play Harry Seldon. I love Jared Harris. I loved him in Mad Men. I loved him in The Expanse. Two very, very different characters. And he's been all over the place. So I'm really looking forward to the miniseries, but we don't know much about it at the moment. So we have the original trilogy, which is mostly what we've talked about so far, which was written in the decade of the 40s. And much later on, he came back and wrote a couple of sequels, in which he tried to expand the story beyond what we had seen in the original series and begin to try to bring it to a conclusion. And then he went back and wrote the prequels, which was a very interesting sequence to go main series in the 40s, sequels, what, in the early 80s? Was it
early 80s, I think.
Early 80s, and then prequels a little bit later than that. And the whole thing, I mean, a big part of that project was an attempt to tie together the three main series that Asimov wrote. So there was the Robot series, which he wrote a little bit after Foundation. There was the Galactic Empire series. I referred to Pebble in the Sky before, which was another different series. And Asimov decided to tie all three of them together and make them into one series. And he had to answer some interesting questions. One of the questions he had to answer was, well, one of your series is about robots, and the other ones have no robots. So how do we go from robots everywhere to robots nowhere? And that was a big part of what both the sequels and the prequels did.
Yeah.
So I've gone back and I've read the prequels. I haven't got to the sequels yet. What are you guys doing as far as your, I know you're very busy with your semester.
Well, actually, I want to take a close look, since I found them on archive.org. I want to take a close look at those original series, because I figure that's the DNA. That was the starting point. And it'd be interesting to think it forward from there. But aside from that, I'm working on rereading Foundation at the moment.
Yeah, I'm just working my way through the original novels as well. I'm halfway through the story of the mule right now.
Right. And one of the debates that we had in putting this podcast together was, what order should we read the books in, or what order should we talk about them? And I was a great proponent of doing them in the chronological order in which they were written, because I think there's a lot to be gained from that. There's the in-world order, which would be prequels, original series, and sequels. But I think that there's a lot to be gained from reading it in the order in which Asimov wrote it, which is original series, sequels, prequels, because I think that in a lot of ways, the prequels themselves are actually sequels, because he had clear goals that he was trying to accomplish in writing the prequels. You know, the sequels were there to extend the story and modernize it a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
Also to link up, you know, to continue that idea of linking it up with the robot series. And then the prequels were there, in my opinion, to do basically three things. One was to take those characters that we all got attached to and say, well, what happened before? We only really saw Harry Seldon for a couple of chapters and a few appearances later on in the series. So let's tell Harry Seldon's story. Let's also, as far as the great retcon, as I like to call it, you know, let's introduce how the robots come back into the story. And also, and this I think he did not do particularly well, was to try to address some of the questions that come up about a science fiction series written in the 40s, which tends to come off a little sexist, a little misogynistic. You know, there's all these references just in the first few chapters of Foundation where, you know, the Empire is very concerned about the 100,000 men that Harry Seldon has gathered as an army. And he says, well, 30,000 men plus their wives and children. You know, and it's always all the scientists are men. Everyone's a man. You know, there's no thought that there could be anything other than kind of a white man running everything. You know?
Yeah, no, Asimov was not woke, and we're gonna have a lot to talk about when we reach these kinds of issues through the novels. I mean, there's plenty to criticize, and I think we might as well go ahead and criticize it because I mean, the TV show. Just from the casting choices, it's obvious that they took more than one character, who was originally male. And probably in Asimov's mind, originally white, mm-hmm. and cast women of color into those roles. So clearly the TV producers have thought about how to update the social ethics of this series. And I think we might as well do the same as we're going through it.
Yeah, but man, don't tell the internet.
Oh, well, I think the internet is going to find out.
Yeah. I really, not to jump too far ahead, but I did find his efforts to do that in the prequels extremely clumsy. I think his idea of making things more equitable was to make Harry Seldon more horny, you know, and that just was really weird.
And then he had people looking forward to that.
No, you really shouldn't be. And then there were this sort of like, oh, this person considers himself an Easterner, and we don't know why. And this one's a Southerner, and you cringe. You really cringe. And this was Asimov at the end of his life, you know, with complete ability to look back on everything, and it was really, really clumsy. But we'll talk about all that later, and the way all of the series and the sequels and the prequels all fit together. There is a lot to talk about. I'm not sure where it's all going to go. You know, how much ancillary stuff we might want to talk about. Other Asimov things, other writers of the same generation. You know, what do you guys, you know, when you think about this, what do you think about as the kind of the topics that you want to hit as we move forward?
I thought about it a little. One of the things that I think I want to think about is how, even revisiting this, I'm seeing commonalities between Foundation and a lot of his other works. You know, like the description of Trantor are very, very reminiscent of stuff they wrote in the Caves of Steel, for example. You know, I think in some ways, you know, we were talking about, you know, the robot's involvement, which I really found off-putting when I read that in the early 80s, when they brought that character in at the end of Foundation and Earth. Maybe there's a more organic basis in there if we look at broader sweeps of his work. I kind of want to, you know, I wasn't a mathematician when I read these first things. I am now. So the idea of psychohistory as a mathematical discipline, I actually want to ponder that some.
I mean, do you find it to be something that sounds plausible to you, or is it something that's just a fun idea but outrageous?
At the moment, I think it's, well, okay, I mean, we have to think we're talking like 12,000 years in the future. Who knows how things could have advanced? But in the meantime, we know a little bit more about chaos theory. What was it? Lorenz, I think, introduced that idea of the butterfly effect, not to be confused with the Bradbury short story, where he was running some weather data. He rounded some of his numbers and then reran the simulation, and it was totally different. You know, and so there's this notion that, you know, same initial conditions that are just barely different can lead to significantly different outcomes. And so, I mean, I think there's this underpinning of randomness that probably at least keeps the version of psychohistory that exists in the first novel from being too plausible. I want to give that some more thought.
I mean, it comes from the idea that Asimov was pondering whether something like the fall of an empire, like the fall of the Roman Empire, was inevitable or not. And if so, was it predictable? But I think it also points up something. I don't know whether this was intentional or not, but, you know, in my very much amateur reading of history, there's two great schools of history, right? There's the great man theory of history, which says that history bounces from great person to great person, and it's those great people who drive the great events of history. On the other side is, I guess, the not great man theory of history that says, I'm not sure what you call it. I'm sure there's a name for it, but I don't know it, which says that these events of history are functions of large groups of people. They're going to happen the way they happen, regardless of whether a great man appears or not. And again, to a little bit of a spoiler alert, we know that the main story of Foundation is in many ways the tension between these two theories of history, because you have the foundation that's been built, Seldon's plan, and then a mutant appears. a single person appears who is able to disrupt the entire plan. Ultimately, there's a story that continues from there that I won't go on about, but it does reflect the tension between those two large schools of historical thinking.
And I wonder, this is like 1940, 1941, and Gallup was just turning polling and statistics into kind of a serious science with realistic predictions. I mean, there are horror stories about the predictions that they tried to make about the 36 and 1940 election. Landon was supposed to win the 1940 election in a landslide, and of course he lost 48 states. But there are people trying to put that on a firm foundation. And I think that one of the things that Asimov might have been thinking is just to take this idea and try to take it to an extreme conclusion. If what we understand about statistics and polling and whatnot is true, kind of reasoning forward, maybe I think you could get to something like psychohistory.
Yeah. There is a discipline called psychohistory out there. Have you guys ever, do you know what it is? I don't even know what it is, really.
There's a real version of psychohistory?
There really is something that calls itself psychohistory.
Yeah, I did not know that.
Yeah,
I have to look into it.
We have to cut this part out. We may have to be able to edit this out.
That's okay. So, I one question that I've been curious to look at as we go through is that, like, at least for the first couple books, like, each little section ties its story to a postulate about the stage of history that the foundation is in, right? And Asimov kind of identifies different kinds of social forces, religion, commerce, so on. On the one hand, it's not worth asking, like, was he right? Because, you know, he's just writing fiction, and this is so far beyond any actual sociology or economics. But I am curious to think about the way he was thinking through these different kind of forces in his own time, and what it means to have speculation about large-scale historical forces coming out of, at first, the middle of the war, yeah, and then on into the 50s. And, you know, to what degree do we get a vision of the future which is really projected out of the kind of gigantic collisions of World War II and its aftermath that he was writing from? And, you know, can we detect any of that in what he was writing from? And what should we do with that today? Like, how should we think about fiction as a vehicle for speculation on the nature of history and the sort of forces that we live through?
Yeah, I think actually that's a great point. The war is a great point, because clearly he began writing this in 1941, just as the United States, probably just before the United States, yeah, got into the war in December of 41, but obviously was carrying on in Europe. Horrific things were happening. People were only just beginning to find out exactly how horrific it was. And one of the things I'd love to do is contrast this with other things that were being written at the same time. And J.R.R. Tolkien is one of my favorite authors. Mm-hmm. And Tolkien was always accused of writing an allegory about World War II, that The Lord of the Rings was an allegory about World War II. And he denied it. And he also hated allegory, but whatever. I don't see World War II in Foundation, even though it was written as the war was carrying on throughout those 4 years from 41 to 45 that the war was going on. I don't see it. And I think that's kind of fascinating also, mm-hmm, that we don't see it so much. There are wars in Foundation, but there is nothing World War II like, and that strikes me as very odd.
It is a good question. There's certainly, one would have to look hard to find a clear analog to it. It's possibly something as simple as the fact that science fiction was a very escapist genre, and maybe he just wanted to write something diversion, you know, from the news of the day.
I was going to say, I wouldn't blame him for wanting to do that.
Well, on the other hand, I suppose you could look at the Galactic Empire and say, does the Third Reich inevitably, is that going to fall because of the forces that always make empires fall? But I don't really see the Galactic Empire as Germany. I really see it as ancient Rome.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a closer analog, to be sure. Maybe it'd be interesting to see how some later post-war installments, if there's any reflection of the nascent Cold War and the kind of collisions that were starting up. But I think perhaps it might be too much to look for any individual incident as like a sort of coded analog to something happening in the real world. I don't think that's where it's going. But I think that probably in general terms, the way in which grand forces of history become something to really ponder upon in the series. Maybe it receives some impulse from his own times, even if he's not kind of covertly alluding to current events.
Thinking back to it, I feel like he's covertly referring to, shall we say, 2018, for example, although he couldn't be, but there's there seems to be to me a lot more parallel in modern America than there was in 1940s America. At least at the very start of the trilogy.
And then, of course, there's the topic of the very large gap in time between when he originally wrote the series and then when he returned to it. While it's true that his style didn't change that much, you know, there were some things that changed. He was certainly more open about sexuality, for example, which, you know, there is none in early Asimov. There's really none in early science fiction. It didn't really have a place in early science fiction. And, you know, later on, you know, it actually took Asimov a long time. I mean, if you look at somebody like Heinlein, who wrote Stranger in a Strange Land and sometime in the 60s.
64-ish, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that went off into, like, if you've never read Stranger in a Strange Land, it's quite progressive compared to 1950s science fiction, let's say. I mean, very explicit, very open. You know, and Heinlein's a whole other interesting character who fascinates me. Took Asimov a long time, but he did get there. You know, I think there's a lot of things that are interesting about that gap in time and why and how he came back to Foundation as he was nearing the end of his own life.
Or science fiction at all. I mean, am I correct in remembering that during that huge interregnum, he wasn't writing science fiction?
I guess, though, he was writing the extended robot series intermittently, right? So those stories were, as you talked about, the Caves of Steel. I think he was producing some of that as time went on. And then later on, tried to unify it with Foundation. You know, another thing that I actually find interesting, just because my background is kind of Eastern European Jews, like Asimov's, is that we don't see a lot of that in any Asimov writing. Every now and then something pokes through. But, you know, he was a child of immigrants who probably spoke with pretty heavy accents. Asimov himself maintained, maybe as an affectation, a little tiny bit of something Eastern European, but his characters are very straight, sort of 1950s, for lack of a better term, yeah, waspy American characters. And like character of Preem Palver, who is kind of a major character at the end in Second Foundation, in Second Foundation, he and his wife, I feel like they were taken from Asimov's own parents or grandparents. You know, they're very much like they're in a spaceport. They've got their bags. You could imagine they'd have a farm animal with them. You know, and they have these
look like they came off the shtetl.
Yeah, exactly. So every now and then he allowed his own background to poke through, but it was rare. It was pretty rare. And I guess you had to write what sells, and, you know, Eastern Europeans don't sell so well in science fiction, I suppose.
Yeah, not in the 40s.
Not in the 40s, no.
And you have to wonder what John W. Campbell, you know, what his influence was there as well.
John W. I said Joseph. I meant John W. Campbell. Yeah, I don't know what his influence was. He was a very interesting guy in his own right, and really was the father of a lot of that pulpy science fiction, which Asimov really thrived on, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm, he was able to produce so much material in short periods of time. You know, he really did very well. He was the perfect writer for the pulp era of science fiction. And I mean, have you ever gone back and you know, looked at any of those kind of pulpy magazine science fiction? I mean, I didn't really. I think growing up, we had Omni, which was like the last gasp of that era. But those previous things, even Asimov science fiction, but fantasy and science fiction, all of those classic magazines from the 40s and 50s, I don't think I've ever actually seen one, to be honest.
Not from that era.
I was going to say, one of the things I've done recently, because I teach a science fiction class at Elmira College every once in a while, usually with a friend of mine from the literature department, you know, I've gone back and sourced some things that I found on the internet so that students could read them inexpensively. And there's a lot of things like on archive.org. And so you could actually go back and look at the original stories in their original context and I find this interesting, the original artwork.
Right. Yeah, some fantastic artwork, you know, some very cartoony stuff, but also some very, you know, just wonderful artwork that I think people are trying to rediscover now. And it's not easy. It's not easy to find this stuff. Mm. You know, I don't know how well archived any of it was, but
it's not well archived at all. Actually, I can kind of speak to that. My grandfather died in 1933. He was the original illustrator of When Worlds Collide for beautiful, beautiful stuff. It's like one of these projects I've been wanting to do for like 20 years is get a website together so that his stuff is out in the world. And I haven't gotten to there yet. But, you know, I think what the family kind of did is you know, after he died, think, well, his stuff is precious. And so we have to bring it into the family and guard it. You know, who knows what his reputation might look like if it were out there and collected and people were much more familiar with it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, that's great.
You should do that. I want to see that now.
Okay. Well,
you're on the clock. You got to get that done.
I'll get that going.
You know, another topic that I would love to talk about at some point is how Foundation fits into the world of science fiction itself and what science fiction is and what science fiction does. You know, small topics, little tiny things about the entire genre of science fiction and the criticism of science fiction that there's too many bug-eyed monsters, too many space cowboys, that it's not serious literature. What does it do well? What could it do? I think there are some things that, you know, I'm going to point to three things that I think Asimov does that are true science fiction. That are just timeless and could not be done outside science fiction. The first one is not really a Foundation thing, which is the three laws of robotics, which is something that lots of other people have kind of clamped onto and stolen over time. You know, the laws of how robots work. We can talk about that later, but I think that's real science fiction because that takes you outside of human beings, outside of modern times, and says, here are the things that drive robots. And they're different from what drives humans. And how does that create stories? And how does that, you know, how do we talk about that? And how does that illuminate the world? And I think within Foundation, I believe that the concept of psychohistory is a true science fiction concept. It really talks about how we look at humanity, how we look at the future, how we look at behavior. And then very much related to that is the second Foundation, as I was talking about before, this idea of a new way of governing ourselves through mental sciences. I think in those areas, and I'm not saying that's the only time that Asimov ever did something great in science fiction, but I think those are great science fiction concepts that can really be looked at. And yeah, Asimov, you know, had his drawbacks as a writer and you know, his characters can be cardboard cutouts, whatever. But, you know, he hit on some things that really are new, different, not present in regular literature.
Yeah, I mean, that I've had many conversations about that, and that's actually a conversation I look forward to having with you guys.
Yeah,
I can talk about that for like, you know, 4 hours.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that he is great at kind of conceptualizing a fictional approach to a problem, right? And that's one of the things which science fiction needs in a way that other sort of normal fiction doesn't, right? And he doesn't do the kind of things that classic high literature is supposed to be better at. Like, he doesn't do great characterization. He's not a master prose stylist. He's not like a kind of avant-garde, you know, experimenter with the form. But science fiction needs to create worlds in a way that average fiction about our common contemporary experience doesn't. And he has this ability to create worlds in ways that pose just fun problems to think about. And I think that that's one of the things that I really appreciate him most for, and why I like coming back to his fiction, even though it's not, you know, literary masterpieces in a lot of ways, but it's worth coming back to and thinking over every now and
then. I actually think it's fascinating that it's particularly in Foundation, but in his other stories as well, he does not do a lot with aliens. There are no aliens in Foundation. There are only humans. And that's pretty typical of Asimov. I'm racking my brains trying to think of Asimov stories with aliens. And
there are a few of his short stories which appear in his collections. Now and then you'll find an alien here and there in one of the short stories that is not connected to his mainline series. But you're right, none of the works in Foundation or the robot series Galactic Empire, none of that do aliens appear anywhere, which is pretty odd.
It is.
Yeah.
The main place I can think of Asimov doing aliens is in The Gods Themselves.
Yes.
Which is outstanding. And the thing that really impressed me about that is that those were aliens that really palpably seemed alien. In a way that you did not get from the vast majority of other science fiction. You know, the vast majority of other science fiction has aliens, but mostly they have the literary equivalent of the putty on their on their nose. They're recognizable humans who happen to be aliens. Still, I think that's one of the best examples of aliens in science fiction.
And that certainly goes to some of the criticism of science fiction in general about aliens. You know, that you have the kind of Star Trek aliens who are, as you say, people with latex on their foreheads. There's a great division between. And I find this true in Star Trek. There's a sort of very upbeat vision. We'll meet aliens and they'll basically be us. And we'll be able to communicate with them. We'll be able to understand what drives them. And then we'll all move together into an optimistic future. And I love Star Trek. I think we all came to this through Star Trek. Yeah. And, you know, that's a great optimistic view. And then there's the sort of pessimistic view, which I would hold up Stanislaw Lem, one of my favorite writers, as the pessimistic view that the communication with aliens should be all but impossible. That they will have developed completely differently from us, have completely different drives. We may not even recognize them as beings, and that the idea of communication, even any communication, is just so remote, and that aliens are so truly remote. And it's actually a very pessimistic view of the future, that we will reach out into the cosmos and find nothing that we can talk to. Mm-hmm. And there really is there's kind of a third school, which is the Arthur C. Clarke school, which says, yeah, there are aliens. They're like us, but they're actually a higher form. Mm-hmm. You know, and you see that in Childhood's End. You see that in 2001, where, yes, we can communicate with the aliens, but it's not going to be us that's communicating with the aliens. It's going to be some evolved version of us that may get to join with those aliens at some point. We, the regular humans, really cannot establish communication with them. So it's a sort of a melding of those two, the optimistic and the pessimistic school. But it is fascinating to me that Asimov became an absolute giant of science fiction, really, other than the couple of examples that we came up with, without, visiting the aliens at all. So I think we at least are interested in this topic, the three of us.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And I hope that we're able to illuminate some things and perhaps we'll have some guests in the future who might bring other viewpoints in, particularly when we talk about, any topic, that it might be interesting to see some other points of view. Clearly, we have identified a lot of topics that we'd like to talk about. I think we've got plenty of time between now and I think it's probably going to be fourth quarter of this year when the miniseries comes out. Yeah, if it comes out at all. You know, it'd be very interesting to see how they approach this. I mean, we've scanned through the cast and said, well, Harry Seldon's in every episode, so how are they approaching the story? But we can only guess at this point. We don't really know, but I'll be fascinated to see. I mean, there've been other miniseries of famous works. Childhood's End was one that I actually liked a lot. I know a lot of people had their criticisms of it. It was only a 3-episode miniseries, but I quite liked it. Sometimes these things are, they're hit or miss. I mean, I look at one of the earliest ones that sci-fi did was Dune, which I thought was much superior to the movie. The movie is a great scar on my life. the David Lean Dune. So we hope for the best, but I think we've got a lot of time between now and when we get to that.
And for our next episode, we'll just be digging into the first of the Foundation novels by publication date. So we'll just start with Foundation and do a read through and talk about it, along with whatever show news we can dig up. Might throw that in a little bit, but we're just going to start by reading through all of the novels until we finally get the show to air.
With luck, it'll match up perfectly. We'll get to the end of the last book. Right,
keep our fingers crossed.
Right as the miniseries begins. All right. Well, any last thoughts before we wrap up for today?
Nah. Let's just leave it there. So, okay. Well, why don't we call it an evening then?
If you want to read along with us, on our next episode in 2 weeks, we'll be covering the first 3 parts of Foundation: the Psychohistorians, the Encyclopedists, and the Mares.
Well, that brings this week's episode to a close. Thanks for listening.
We'd like to thank Quinn Blumenfeld for editing the episode. Also, we'd like to credit the music, which is used by a Creative Commons license. It's called It Is Coming by Alex Mason.
Goodbye from the galactic capital of Trantor. This is where the stars end.